are listening to a free version of The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
If you like the stories you hear on The Majority Report, then check out the Sierra Club's new storytelling podcast, The Land I Trust. Season 2 of The Land I Trust brings you 14 storytellers from across the Western U.S., who share their experiences in harvesting, protecting, and living with the four natural elements, with tales of climate change, clean energy, and everything in between. Listen to The Land I Trust at beyondcoal.org/stories. That's beyondcoal.org/stories, or on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, September 20th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the 5-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, professor of history at Columbia University, Adam Tooze, on Crashed, How a Decade of Financial Crises Changed the World. Also on the program today, Kavanaugh reportedly had look requirements for female clerks. And the latest on Monday's possible testimony. Also on the program today, bipartisan Senate passes a spending bill, funds Health and Human Services, and also gives the Pentagon a raise. Phew, finally. As Jeff Sessions decrees that indefinite detention will be the course for asylum seekers, more Health and Human Services cuts to fund child detention. Andrew Cuomo still screwing over New York Dems. And a new report shows that the so-called idea debaters are actually gateway to white nationalists. Republican Governor hopeful DeSantis's campaign with yet another racist slip. And apparently, Sean Hannity was the one who told Donald Trump to declassify Russia investigation material while the investigation continues. And lastly, Mike Pompeo, you'll recall last week, certified that the Saudis were not killing civilians in Yemen. Turns out he did so despite all of his staff saying don't do it. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Yes, folks, it is Thursday. Welcome to the program. This will be, well, we've got that trip to Las Vegas for the TORT conference in the first week of October. But, you know, we're now have the Jewish holidays in the River Muir. This week will be the last week that is funky. We will get back to some semblance of normalcy. Of course, we won't get back to any sense of normalcy for a long time in this country, but at least the program will be more or less as it usually is. It is unclear at this point what's going to happen Monday. As you know, at the beginning of the week, I guess it was Tuesday, maybe by Monday, it appeared that Christine Blasey Ford would be testifying on Monday of next week. At this juncture, subsequent to her attorney saying, I guess so, on Sunday morning or Monday morning, that she would testify, she requested, which is basically par for the course, an FBI investigation into the matter. Now, it would be very weird for someone who is lying to request an FBI investigation, which could quite possibly debunk what she's saying. I mean, if she was to get up there and say there was no, and it was quite clear that the committee was aware, like the FBI wasn't able to substantiate any of your claims that there was a party, that they were there, that anybody heard about this, none of it. And on the contrary, we know that there was or was not a party. We know that there was or was not other people at that party. And the FBI could dig into it. But the Republicans don't want that. They want just to put an accuser up there who is very nervous about being in public because of the death threats that have obviously followed since she came out, et cetera, et cetera.
She's got daughters.
And the Republicans are hoping that she would say she would not show up. It's quite possible she may not show up on Monday. However, it's also quite possible that she may start going on television on Friday. And by Sunday, maybe she's on 60 Minutes. And she's telling her story. Now, Brett Kavanaugh is not going to go on 60 Minutes. It would be awkward for him to do so. So it's unclear what happens. It's unclear what happens if the Republicans go ahead and vote for Brett Kavanaugh, having essentially driven the witness away from a hearing. And what it's going to mean for someone like Collins or Murkowski. So there's a lot of things up in the air at this point. There's also this other story, and we don't know what the status is of it, of federal judicial employees who may have some information involving Brett Kavanaugh's awareness that his mentor, Kaczynski, famous judge, federal judge, who was brought down by his own problems with sexual, I don't know if it was quite assault, but it certainly was inappropriate.
Impropriety.
Showing porno to his clerks and whatnot. I don't know what the status is of that. We may run tomorrow for members, an interview I did that will play on Ring of Fire radio. So if you happen to live in a place where Ring of Fire plays terrestrially, we may run an interview I did with Ryan Grimm, who broke both of these stories. They're big stories. And I floated for him, is there any chance the Republicans were somewhat interested in keeping this seat vacant? He had that thought too, he said, but hasn't heard anybody articulate that. It definitely appears now that they would like to vote Kavanaugh in. But this is changing minute to minute, I really do think. And so we will see. We will see what goes forward. But interesting detail on this video, which you may or may not have seen by now. Brett Kavanaugh apparently giving a speech. And where was he giving this speech?
American University.
At American University. And he was talking about his attending Catholic University of America's Columbus School of Law. And I guess he was making a couple of jokes about it. But before he did, and I want to make sure that we provide this entire context here, at least I will read it off, because I don't know if we have the video. Apparently the speech went like this. Our motto at Georgetown Prep was to be men for others. It was an all-boys school. To be men for others, Kavanaugh said. And I know this school This is, he was at American University. This school helps teach its students to be lawyers for others, to serve the public, and to serve others who are in need. He went on to discuss teachers and coaches he had and sayings of theirs that he recalled. Then he said this.
We had a good saying that we've held firm to this day, as the dean was reminding me before.
Oh, pause it. Okay, let me just add. He said, I, by coincidence, three classmates of mine at Georgetown Prep were graduates of this law school in 1990 and are really, really good friends of mine, Mike Bidwill, Don Ergo, and Phil Merkel. And they were good friends of mine, and they are still good friends of mine as recently as this weekend when we were all on email together. Now started from the beginning.
We had a good saying that we've held firm to this day, as the dean was reminding me before the talk, which is what happens at Georgetown Prep stays at Georgetown Prep. That's been a good thing for all of us, I think.
Yeah, all of us. All three of them. And fortunately, he started that saying. So here he is saying that at this speech. Now, don't want to make too much of this. There's a published version of this speech. And the chunk of speech that I just read off about these sayings was edited out. Now, law school articles, they edit this stuff pretty rigorously. Maybe it wasn't relevant. Maybe the stuff about
put that in the memory hole.
Yeah,
really wasn't.
I mean,
relevant.
Who knows? It wasn't in the article. But the point being that there's a story to be told, apparently, at this school. And if we wanted to know that story, they would let the other person who is accused of being in the room, Mark Judge, testify. He has refused to testify. He could be subpoenaed. Seems fairly relevant, right? I mean, you want to exonerate this Supreme Court justice before he sits on the court, but apparently they don't think it's that important to have Mark Judge there. In his 1997 memoir, Wasted Tales of a Gen X Drunk, Mark Judge was talking about 100 kegs or bust that he and Kavanaugh referenced on their prep school yearbook. Who knows? I guess we shall see. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Professor Adam Tooze on his book, Crashed, How a Decade of Financial Crises Changed the World. We'll be right back after this.
Yeah.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program a professor of history at Columbia University, author of The Deluge, and his most recent is Crashed, How a Decade of Financial Crises Changed the World. Adam Tooze, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
Now, we're almost, I don't know, almost to the day, I guess maybe 4 or 5 days, but pretty close to the 10-year anniversary of Lehman's meltdown, essentially, which was really the, I guess the, I don't know, the bell ringing in terms of this financial crisis. I think there's a sense, there's not necessarily a sense for most folks in this country how sort of international this crisis was at that moment. Can you, before we go back and sort of do a run-up to what happened in this country and the sort of the political decisions that followed in its wake, can you give us a sense of why there was of the impact internationally and why for a crisis that emanated presumably in the United States?
Well, it's because the global banking system is so deeply interconnected. So American banks like Lehman do a lot of their business in what are for American banks offshore centers like the City of London. American money market mutual funds were deeply invested in the debt of European banks. European banks had then flushed the Eurozone, notably Ireland and Spain, with credit to create housing bubbles that were much, much larger in proportional terms than the US housing bubble. And Ireland is small, but Spain isn't. Spain is a Texas-sized chunk of the global economy. And then European banks had returned quite a lot of that money to the United States and invested very heavily in securitized subprime. And all of the banks in the world, whether or not they're actually invested in subprime, all take money from an increasingly large amount of money since the 1990s from what's called the wholesale money market. So the interbank market and borrow directly from funds of various types. And as the panic spreads, already weeks before Lehman, but Lehman really brought it to a head. No bank anywhere in the world can get funding anymore in those interbank markets, in those money markets. And that produces a global heart attack. So it goes all the way from South Korea and Russia to, of course, the United States. But by way of most of the major banking centers of Europe, Frankfurt, Paris, London, the Benelux, so Belgium and Netherlands, are all, and Switzerland, of course, are all massively affected. And then that begins to spill outwards towards Eastern Europe and Northern Europe, by way of the Baltic states and Denmark and Sweden. So it's truly an interconnected system. Globalization is for real. Banks are at the cutting edge of it. And so a crisis anywhere affects everyone.
And is it the same as it travels through the sort of that blood stream? In other words, the what was problematic in the States was the same as or created the same problem internationally, or was it a change depending on the locality, how downstream from the initial heart attack, I guess, was? I mean, and explain to us, yep. Like, are we talking about sort of there's just no liquidity, or is it just that everybody basically called in their chips at the same time?
Well, that's what everyone calling in their chips at the same time causes the liquidity problem. No bank is safe if that happens. All of the banks were fishing from the same pool of liquidity. So really, in the first instance, what's happening in September 2008 is pretty much the same crisis all across the world. I mean, when we say there's no liquidity, what we mean is just it's very, very expensive. And it was marginally more expensive in Europe to get dollar liquidity than in the U.S., but that was enough to cause an absolute crisis in Europe. The European banks are larger in their balance sheets, not just in relative, but in the absolute terms than their American counterparts. Lehman is a relatively modest-sized bank, but there are several banks in Europe which can go toe-to-toe with the very biggest, you know, Bank of America and Citigroup in the U.S. And they're all simultaneously suffering this massive loss of liquidity conditioned by uncertain losses on their portfolios of real investments, which will or will not be realized sometime down the line, but no one wants to hang around to find out. So everyone is pulling their funding simultaneously. And that then begins to feed out very rapidly from the financial sector to the real economy. So within weeks, Chinese factories are shutting down, German factories are shutting down, Mexican factories are shutting down. This moves very quickly from being a real estate crisis to being a banking crisis to being a crisis of the whole world economy. The most rapid fall on trade ever recorded happened.
I'm sorry, Professor, we're losing you just a little bit. Yeah. I don't know if it's...
The most severe collapse in global trade ever recorded happened in the final months of 2008. So, this moves very quickly from being a real estate crisis to a banking crisis to a full-blown economic crisis.
Okay, and Professor, I don't know if you're on a headset or what, but it's cutting in a little bit, cutting out just a little bit. If you're on a headset, maybe it would be best to go directly into the phone. But all right, so. But continuing forward, so moving backwards, I should say, at that point, what in the run up to 2008, like how big is the wind up? Like where would you start counting the sort of the path to this crisis? And I guess maybe, and it's your decision as to where it was inevitable versus where there could have been short circuits that would have prevented getting to where we got to.
Well, if you're talking about the subprime real estate bubble, that blows up really quite quickly from 2003-04 onwards. Early in the new century, Greenspan dumps interest rates in response to the dot-com bubble bursting. And the shock of 9/11, and that produces, as you could expect, a huge surge in refinancing business in the United States. It also reduces interest rates around the world and helps the bubble to the boom to get going in Western Europe as well. But that first phase is actually pretty much conforming standard low-risk mortgages. It's really from 2004 onwards that you get this sudden burst of what are called private label. So not Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac authorized mortgages.
I'm sorry, Professor. I'm sorry, we're having trouble with your phone. Maybe we'll call you right back if that's okay.
I hear you. Okay, I'm sorry. I hear you absolutely fine.
Okay. All right. Let me call you right back. We'll call you right back, folks. We'll be right back in just a moment. All right, Professor. Thank you. Apologies. So you're saying that in the early aughts, we saw a Greenspan basically dropping interest rates and juicing, in many respects, the returns that were coming from the housing market. And then in 2004, we entered into a slightly different phase.
Yes, exactly. This is really one driven by private label securitization and mortgages. So this is the classic subprime phase. And that's very sharp, very sudden. It results in about $1 trillion worth of lending. And that's the bit which then ultimately tips very suddenly in 2007 into crisis mode. It would, however, not have led to the comprehensive crisis that we saw in 2008 if it had not been for the fact that over a longer time horizon, really back to the 1980s and early 1990s, banking globally had moved to a model of banking funding, which was based on wholesale markets and the financing of fixed income assets. And it's really that, the combination of the two things, the surge in subprime from 2004, funded through a model which had been developing since the 1990s, which relies on this short-term money market-based funding. It's a combination of those things together that produces the possibility of 2008.
So our avoidance of that situation could have either been a function of changing the broader context of our financial markets, or preventing that sort of, injection of a high wire act in 2004, essentially, right? That the securitization on steroids.
Yes, I think so. If all hands had been on deck on the regulatory side from 2004 onwards, it's possible that they might have been able to suppress some of the really low quality subprime securitization that goes on. The risks that needed to be worried about were not really, not even the Countrywides or the Washington Mutuals. What caused systemic risk was the fact that, this stuff was accumulating on the balance sheets of the Citigroups and the Lehmans, which had the massive networked interconnection with the entire financial system. So it's one thing if your mortgage lenders, specialized mortgage lenders, go bad, which is what happened, say, in the savings and loans crisis of the 1980s. It's quite another if keystone commercial banks, high street banks, or keystone investment banks are entangled in that same mess. And the other thing, I guess, that would have had to have happened to contain this is global regulation of banking of a much tighter variety of the type that we have now with what's called Basel III. So a much closer attention to both the capitalization of the banks to increase their ability to absorb losses and liquidity, in other words, their ability to withstand runs of funding. And those have really been the key centers of attention in global bank regulation since the crisis.
To broaden out a little bit, what was the what were the narratives that the broader narratives that either in Europe or in this country that people had been operating under, like broad misconceptions that I guess 2008 sort of upended in many respects?
Well, I think that the most obvious one is the idea that markets and private actors, businesses in markets, can be expected to adequately insure their own risks by way of various types of derivative product. And this was fundamental to the laxness of banking regulation before 2008. The assumption was that the best risk models were the risk models that the banks themselves operated, because they knew best. They had obviously an interest in not self-destructing. And so surely to goodness, if one simply followed the best practice of the bank, then all would be well. And that clearly turned out to be a profound miscalculation. More broadly, I think what we've had to come to terms with is the fact that the fate of big private actors cannot be separated from the fate of the entire economy. This is the too big to fail problem. So not only are private actors not really capable of fully assessing the risks that they face, but when they make mistakes, if they're of a sufficiently large type, it has ramifications for everybody, which forces us then into public action of an unprecedented type. And so there you have a whole interconnected set of assumptions that really have come unstuck. And if you go back to somebody like Greenspan, when he was asked in 2007 who he was going to vote for in 2008, he simply said, it doesn't matter who I vote for, because we're fortunate enough to be in a world in which is basically governed by markets. So it doesn't matter who is the chief executive of the United States. It doesn't matter who the president is, except for foreign policy, except for security policy. And that obviously is the sort of the most fundamental delusion that was really blown apart by 2008.
there's a big whoopsie after that, it seems to me. So let's talk about those political the implications. I mean, in this in Europe, in some respects, well, let's talk about the political ramifications and the decisions that were made and the implications. Let's start in this country, and then we will move around the globe.
Well, I mean, I think in the U.S., what you see is this stark disjuncture, right, between a relatively effective technocratic management of the crisis itself, which, given its epic scale and the dangers that were involved, is quite remarkable in its own right. And by the summer of 2009, the immediate risk to the cardiovascular system of the United States economy has passed. The banking system is not fixed, but it is on the mend. And the real economy begins to recover from the second half of 2009, in part because of stimulus action, in part because of the recovery of confidence, the fact that things stopped getting worse. So that's, as it were, one side of the ledger. But on the other side of the ledger is the fact that the party political system as we know it is showing signs of coming apart at the seams, basically. And you began to see that already in the summer of 2008, and it's most visible. And it's very consequential, obviously, all the way down to the present inside the Republican Party, because at the height of the crisis in the summer and fall of 2008, a Republican presidency struggling to contain this crisis cannot get the votes of its own party in Congress to support the bailout of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac or TARP, the instrument they use to recapitalize the American banks. And it relies essentially on the opposition in Congress, the Democrats, to do the deal. Do the deals that are necessary. And in 2009, with Obama in the White House, you then have this extraordinary kind of combination of both absolutely bloodthirsty partisan opposition in Congress by the leadership of the Republican Party and, you know, an insurgency at the grassroots in the form of the Tea Party, which already has many of the elements of the alt-right, which, you know, have spiraled down to the present. And then on the other side of the divide, as disillusionment with the Obama presidency really sets in. By the fall of 2011, of course, you have the Occupy movement, which I take to be symbolic of a much broader disaffection of the left wing of American politics with the entire spectrum of mainstream parties in Washington. And so in that respect, you know, this sort of triple, on the one hand, as it were, technocratic management, but then fraying of the ability of either the Democrats or the Republicans to contain these tensions, that really, I think, you know, marks American politics and shapes the 2016 election.
I'm curious from your perspective how those two, the Republicans reacting and refusing early on to fund the bailout, as it were, and then Occupy, those two phenomenons on different ideological, like, how would you characterize them in relationship to the crisis? In other words, what? Because to me, it seems like Occupy was a reaction to the way that the Obama administration responded, right? Like, not enough stimulus, too much austerity. And by 11, you know, there had been a pivot to austerity versus the right and the Tea Party, which seemed to be a sort of taking advantage of an opportunity.
Well, I think, I mean, on the one, I'd agree with that, but I also think that what we're seeing in the Republican response to the crisis is something more systemic, which is a profound reluctance on the part of a substantial body of Republicans to see public action, to see American government as in any way a creative and positive force in American society, and a profound fear that the state, the state machinery with its powers of taxation and coercion and so on, will be turned against whatever they take to be, you know, the heart and soul of America. And that expresses it itself in lots of different forms. Part of it is that they in fact share with some people in the Occupy movement an analysis of the cronyism that's, you know, turned federal government into a tool for the support of Wall Street. But much more importantly, and fundamental for the Tea Party, is essentially a kind of anti-welfare protest. You know, the Tea Party doesn't start as a protest against the bailout of Wall Street. It starts as a protest against the possibility, the mere idea, which, of course, the Obama administration doesn't really ever follow through on, of a wholesale bailout for over-indebted American households who can't cope with their mortgages. That very idea is enough to launch the Tea Party. But in that, you know, what triggers there is this much deeper, much more fundamental set of questions about what government in America is for in a society which this part of the American political spectrum sees as drifting as a result of the culture wars and civil rights and so on in fundamentally the wrong direction. And so all of that fear and hostility towards the current trends in American society, culture, politics, and so on, manifests itself in a refusal to allow government to do anything really other than fight wars and mobilize troops and build the security apparatus. But any other function of government is illegitimate. And faced with the kind of crisis that we saw in 08, that's, of course, profoundly dysfunctional, because at that moment, the business sector, which, of course, Republicans profess to support and to honor as, you know, the great driving entrepreneurial force of American society, actually needs government support, which just doesn't fit into their vision of the world. So this is where you get this dysfunction and this split between the kind of managerial figures like Paulson and Bernanke, who are both mainline conservatives, and the party which they think they belong to, which is basically digging in its heels and acting as a kind of party of protest, essentially, at that moment.
That's fascinating. So and I guess to a certain extent, theoretically, American politics revolves around that access of how people view government's role. And so if I understand you correctly, the right was responding to a fear that government would actually take a role, a front seat role, I guess, in fixing this crisis. And the left by 2011 was upset that it had not taken as much of a role as it should have.
Yes, absolutely. It had been nowhere near done enough. And the role that it had played had been predictably once more, you know, massively asymmetric and in favor of big business and not in favor of ordinary Americans. And so those are the accusations. And there is a part of the left which, of course, then says, oh, well, fine, you know, we should smash the government as well. But that is by no means the dominant element. The predominant memory is surely the New Deal and its more radical phases, in which, or even maybe the Great Society moment, Head Start and civil rights and so on. Obviously, the American government has, in several different instances, played an absolutely fundamental role, certainly in the progressive narrative of American history. So, yes, I think that is really the best way to understand this. And of the two narratives at a moment of crisis, there's no question that the Democratic Party's narrative has more purchase on reality.
So what happens as this as we move across the globe in terms of, because presumably as we hit different countries and they are struck by this crisis, they have a different pre-existing ideological debate, or do they? Or I would imagine some countries do, but
no, they absolutely do. That is the right way to think of it. The idea that there is, you know, a crisis and then populism emerges out of this everywhere, and then you sort of cherry pick your way through the list of candidates is, I think, absolutely the wrong way to understand this. I do think, precisely as you suggested, if we think of this as an earthquake, you know, how much damage an earthquake does depends on how close you are to the epicenter and how well your building was built and how well it's been maintained. And those are the key elements. And across the political systems of the West and the countries affected by this crisis, we see a corresponding range of, you know, in some cases we can see analogous responses where the buildings were similarly constructed or they had similar, you know, politics maintaining them at various points. And then we also see radically divergent responses. So Spain, Greece, Portugal, even Italy, one way of reading the Five Star Movement there, have very powerful left-wing responses to the crisis. We have radical governments in both Greece and Portugal that come out of this. Countries which in many ways were less badly affected by the crisis, like Britain, nevertheless, as a result in part of the reaction to the austerity politics adopted by the Conservative government in 2010, see a turn towards this recalcitrant nationalist movement of Brexit, which itself draws on very long-standing traditions of Europhobia in Britain. So that's, I think, exactly the right way to think about this as a similar shock, an interrelated, deeply interrelated shock, which has a profoundly different political impact depending on the pre-existing structures in each case.
How much of what follows then begins to create a new set of crises, I guess? In other words, to extend the earthquake metaphor, the earthquake happens, but then there's a tsunami, or the earthquake happens and then we get an explosion from a nuclear power plant.
No, this is great. And I haven't thought about it that way, but that's exactly how I would see something like Ukraine. So in the Ukraine crisis of 2013, you might think, what's that got to do with the financial crisis? I mean, surely this is just due to, long-standing legacies of Russian ambition, the post-Cold War anxiety in the East and so on. And all of that's true. But Ukraine is in harm's way, and Ukraine puts itself in harm's way because it's in desperate financial trouble. And it's in desperate financial trouble, of course, because of pre-existing problems, but also because it had the 2008 financial crisis had a devastating impact on Ukraine's economy. It was probably the worst affected economy in the world by 2008, because it's hugely dependent on foreign funding and hugely dependent on the export of steel. And no one wants steel when investment is plunging. So you can't understand the frantic way in which Kiev was bargaining back and forth between the EU and Moscow unless you understand that it was desperately trying to escape from an IMF program, which it had slid into in 2008. And then, of course, the other things kick in. Then, of course, the botched EU diplomacy and the aggression of Moscow unhinges the situation and creates the crisis that we know. But that's precisely the sort of ripple effect and then causality that we see around the world following on from this.
Coming back to the States and the way that our government addressed it, I mean, how would you characterize this? And when we look at the players, Geithner and Paulson to a certain extent, where on the spectrum are they even involved? Like, how much of those pre-existing narratives are they deploying, or is their response less ideological and just more completely transactional based upon, for lack of a better word, like who their friends were?
Hi, this is a great question. I mean, who their friends were really matters. And the fact that they were all at least colleagues, if not friends, really makes the American situation unique, I think, in the incredibly kind of tight-knit community that was built from the 90s onwards. It really, I think, starts under the Clinton administration. That's at least when it becomes bipartisan. The network that connects Washington, the Treasury, to the New York Fed and Wall Street just becomes so close. So the men assembled in that room, Sheila Bair is the only woman who is present on the 13th of October, 2008, are all, even though Hank Paulson is sitting across the desk on the other side of the desk, he's the ex-colleague of the former CEO of Goldman Sachs, all of the bankers sitting on the other side of the table. And when Geithner is appointed Treasury Secretary, it has become such a standing assumption that the Treasury Secretary is an ex-Goldman Sachs man, that everyone imagines that he is, even though, in fact, he's a career public servant up to that point. So those social networks play a key role. I think the other thing which they mobilize are narratives of action, of executive power, of emergency management, which, in fact, in the American case, are heavily indebted to America's military experience of recent decades. Something that marks America is quite different from Europe. You don't see a lot of German crisis fighters talking about, the Powell Doctrine, which is derived from, the Vietnam War and its aftermath. So not a lot of Clausewitzians in the German finance ministry, let's put it that way, in the way that there are on the American side. But I do think ideology plays a role as well. I mean, if you listen to people like Geithner, it's quite clear that options like nationalizing a major American bank above and beyond what they did anyway with taking a government stake by way of TARP in all of the banks, the idea of breaking up Citigroup, for instance, and resolving it with perhaps temporary government ownership, what was called the Swedish option in 2009, that was really a long way from anything that he ever wanted to take seriously and consider. And this was fully endorsed by Barack Obama as well. I mean, Barack Obama is a absolutely a centrist on these kind of issues, gives a very revealing interview in 2009 where he says, you know, that's just not something we're going to do. We understand that it worked well in Sweden. They had a banking crisis. They nationalized all their banks, restructured, and then privatized them again. We're just not going to do that here. That's not the way. That's not the American way. So there is a, I think there are really deeply entrenched ideological lines which shape this, despite the pragmatism and the social networks and so on that are also shaping the crisis response.
We spoke to David Dayan, a writer who I think cited you actually in his writing about Geithner over the past week or so as people revisit that time. And yeah. I can't quite remember the quote, but it had something to do with Geithner basically just swimming in certain waters. It was almost, you know, it was preordained. And this had to do with Geithner, I guess, refusing to even provide for Obama the requested game plan if they were to take that Swedish option.
Yes, exactly. I mean, and Geithner has contested this. All of this goes back to Suskind's book about the Obama administration, which was very hotly contested by the Obama administration itself. It was damaging to them politically when it came out. And Geithner went on the record to flatly deny that he did slow walk the Citigroup proposal. So in fairness to him, one should put that on the record that he refuses this this narrative. But it is attested by several people that in the crucial meeting in the spring of 2009, the resolution of the meeting was that a game plan for the resolution of Citigroup was to be prepared, and this is what the president ordered, and it never happened. And what instead happened was the stress testing system, which Geithner preferred as the model to do this. There's no doubt that, you know, the Citigroup nexus that was organized around Robert Rubin was key to how the entire Obama economics team was recruited. You know, it's a very dense network that revolves around Rubin. You know, the emails that on which the shortlists of candidates for Obama cabinet positions were compiled came out of Citigroup email servers. So, you know, there's an undeniable sociology to this network.
Right.
And one has to say it's highly functional. I mean, compared to what we see in Europe, the ability of the American elite, for better or worse, to coordinate its action at this moment is decisive in producing the coherent, comprehensive solution that emerges. Obviously, at considerable political cost, because not enough was done, if you like, to offset the quite legitimate impression that there was basically a kind of oligarchic cabal running the show. Which, you know, this is a first approximation. It's not a bad description of what was happening.
Now, I mean, this is the fascinating and sort of the scary. One of the scary parts about this is that from a technocratic perspective, they solved the crisis. They made political choices as to who would pay the cost of it in the long run. And you talk about a political cost, but at the end of the day, it is a political cost in the same way their relationship to this political cost is almost identical to my relationship to the New England Patriots losing last weekend. I'm super bummed about it. They're my team. But at the end of the day, it doesn't impact me at all. Right? Like, right? Like all of these people, the political cost for them with Donald Trump is their taxes got cut. I mean, so their banking regulations got relaxed. There has been no cost for their decisions. It is a perfect model, it seems to me, of privatizing the profits and socializing the cost. And the political cost, it's unclear to me because none of these people have paid really any price. The Democrats, theoretically, right? Maybe Hillary Clinton, maybe some of these people would have had jobs, but there doesn't seem to be a cost that is borne by anyone within that social world, that circle.
I mean, I see you. I take your point that it's kind of, you know, heads I win, tails you lose, from the point of view of the narrow domain of banking regulation and so on.
But I'm talking about like 90% of the people in this country. Right? I mean, like the decisions that they could have made at any juncture where we're going to bail out the homeowners, where we are going to break up the big banks so that, you know, there's no future systemic risk. All of these costs were borne by the vast majority of Americans. I mean, and I imagine also we could see a similar story in Europe, although it's complicated by, you know, sort of the competence question and their ability to act, you know, efficiently. But it seems to me all the cost has been borne by actually like everyone else. Like,
I don't want to be pushed into the position of like defending the record of the Obama administration. But I mean, the answer that they would give, the answer that, you know, somebody like Geithner will give is that the American taxpayer makes a profit on the bailouts. So the crisis itself is a huge shock to the American economy, and that's where the cost is. The crisis itself is a disaster for millions of people who lose their homes, who suffer unemployment. That's where the cost is. The response of the government in the end paid for itself. And in terms of fixing structural problems in the U.S., in U.S. society, the Obama administration took the considered decision that healthcare was the priority. This was the policy that would touch all Americans, especially lower income Americans, and that was their political priority. And given the limited political capital they had, they were going to do stimulus first and foremost, which they did right from, you know, from the word go. As soon as Obama's elected, they're working on that. And then their next priority is healthcare, and everything else is secondary to that. They do the political arithmetic on other options, including doing homeowner bailouts, and just decide that the arithmetic is not good enough to make it worth making a big push on this side. So it's going to be macroeconomic policy, a bailout which pays for itself, and healthcare. And those are going to be the three strands. Now, I mean, that's, I think, the best case you can make for the Obama administration. And that is the case that they will try and make. And obviously, you're absolutely right that the what costs remain are indeed burdened on the hugely disadvantaged minority that hit by the immediate force of the shock. And above all, it's the minority communities of the United States, right, that suffer the hit, because it's their wealth, such as it is, that's invested above all in real estate. And the Latino and African-American communities of the United States suffer losses to their median household wealth that they will probably, you know, will never recover from in any real meaningful sense, right? That money is never coming back. And over generations, we will talk about entire communities which are much poorer than they were in 2007. So, no, those shocks, that damage is real. And, of course, we have all the ongoing effects of global change in this economic structure, which impact blue-collar, relatively less educated Americans severely and continue to impact them severely. And whilst government is doing this crisis fighting, it can't be minding the store on other issues. And so you have terrible cuts to education, which is presumably the bedrock of any public response across many of the states of the United States, because as much fiscal give as the federal government is doing, it's being taken away at the state level in many, many cases. So I agree with you, but the defense the Obama administration would make is you know, in those terms.
Okay, and fair enough. I appreciate your holding their brief to a certain extent. Let me just ask you one more question about that, and then I just want to go up to where we are in present day. The reported story that Barney Frank tells about Paulson saying all we need, this is when he was president-elect, all we need is President-elect Obama to sign off on bailing out the homeowners as the path in which to inject these funds, as opposed to going to the banks and hoping the banks then do principal reductions. Reportedly, Barney Frank says that he went to Obama and wanted Obama's sign off, and Obama's response is, "We only have one president at a time," type of thing. How does that fit into that narrative?
Well, I think all around TARP, there are a whole series of negotiations going on. I mean, TARP itself, which ultimately was used to recapitalize the banks, was sold the second time round to Congress as a measure that would provide substantial relief to homeowners. And then, of course, virtually none of the TARP funds were used for relief for homeowners. So there is an incredible amount of political jostling going on in those panic-stricken months in 2008, with different parties quite clearly, I think, aware of the political costs of different options. No one overly anxious to carry the can of responsibility until they absolutely have to. And so that kind of politicking seems to me to ring true as a description of what's going on in those 4 months.
Okay, and so all right, so let's jump forward 10 years later. What's the outlook? I mean, because that's the part that sort of scares me, is that I think all of those people involved in that crisis are convinced that what they did was not only successful in salvaging the economy, but the only choice that they could have made, as opposed to a menu of other choices that could have been effective, but would have helped a different, would have, you know, helped the horse instead of the cart, as it were, or however you want to sort of envision that. They helped the broad mass of people and allow their success to buoy the banks versus, you know, the success of the banks to sort of somehow catch up ultimately with the rest of the people.
Well, I mean, I think that with regard to the diagnosis of the crisis itself, I mean, Ben Bernanke and Paulson and Geithner have all been very much on the record in the last couple of weeks restating their side of the story. And it's difficult, I think, to argue with Ben Bernanke's latest report he did for Brookings. Use a medical analogy here. It's as though a very, very bad case of the flu was overlaid by a heart attack. And what happened in 2007 was that an extremely bad case of the flu, obviously this doesn't make any sense in medical terms, but was then triggered a heart attack. And once the heart attack hits, once your cardiovascular system starts shutting down, there really isn't any alternative to the kind of measures that were taken in 08. You have to recapitalize. You have to do liquidity provision on a huge scale. You probably have to do asset purchases. There isn't, you know, one could argue around the edges about maybe using some more comprehensive bankruptcy provision over the summer of 2008 to just catch a lot of the pieces as they were falling and allow more of them to fall, perhaps even, so as to impose some of the losses where they really belong on the banks and their shareholders. But nevertheless, once that heart attack phase end starts up, you know, you really have to do those things, because otherwise the show is just going to stop. So the argument then is really, how does the element of the flu, how does the element of the business cycle that is to do with the real estate boom and the real estate bust, how do we address those problems as well, that pain, those losses? And to my mind, the single most important and most equitable response is massive fiscal policy. You know, homeowner relief is problematic because basically what you're doing is bailing out all sorts of people who've taken on loans which they probably shouldn't have taken on. And as we know, in the really hot spots of the United States, a lot of this was actually speculative. And this isn't the hard luck stories. This is the stories of middle-class Americans deciding they want to go into a little bit of real estate speculation. And that happened on a very large scale in the hot spots of the U.S. That isn't necessarily where you want to target relief. But fiscal policy of an adequate scale, a $2 trillion stimulus rather than a $750 billion stimulus, seems to me to be the way in which one should think about addressing these problems across the board. And that's simply a matter of politics. Can you get a $2 trillion stimulus through Congress? And the chances of doing that now are much slimmer than they were, of course, in 2008.
I just have to push back on on that one premise, that it was that the bulk of this was in certainly
in hotspots.
So you're talking Florida.
In hotspots, it really is. In places like Arizona, the percentage of second and third mortgages is enormous in 2007.
Right. I agreed. But when we're talking about, you know, 1.5 million foreclosures or 1.2.
Oh yeah.
I mean, certainly. giving relief to those people. We're just stopping widespread suffering, right? I mean,
exactly. And there's various ways of doing this short of giving relief. You can stay the foreclosure procedures. There's of course a wide variety of techniques that can be used to stabilize this. But in a more positive vein, all of those are difficult to argue. They're extremely technical. They're complex, and they are, in a sense, you know, fighting the symptoms. You're fighting the distress. Whereas, if the main problem is that the national economy is entering a recession,
right,
which
fair
will
enough,
depress house prices for years on end, then a big classic stimulus measure seems to me to be much more promising.
Right. And it's not an either-or situation, we should say,
no,
at that point.
Ideally, you'd want to do both. Absolutely, ideally, you'd want to do both.
Okay, so lastly, how precarious is our situation now? I mean, we have seen sort of like the slow degradation of Dodd-Frank, almost analogous to what we're seeing with the Affordable Care Act, which, in my estimation, makes a pretty good argument for taking a meat cleaver to these things rather than trying to perform surgery, where you simply restructure the way that these things are regulated or designed so that you can't unwind it as easily as it's been unwound by 2 years of Trump and a Republican Congress. But where are we in terms of the next crisis?
Well, we're clearly heading in the wrong direction. But I think it's important to distinguish, you know, crises and crises. 2008 was a uniquely severe shock. We've not seen anything like that before in history, full stop. And so, you know, I'm not expecting a repetition of something like that. Certainly not with the same structure, which really was fundamentally transatlantic, European and American at the same time. We're not, I don't think, at risk of anything like that, apart from anything else, because the European economy is so lame. Where we could see some risks of an analogous type would be in America's relationship with the emerging markets. But that's a very complex sort of futuristic scenario that's only really beginning to unfold. But in the meantime, you know, one can't disagree. I mean, the evisceration of Dodd-Frank is terrible for the stability and of the American financial system in the long run, because troublesome as that system was and perhaps overly bureaucratic for the smaller banks, it nevertheless provided, you know, really the only major and significant changes that came out of the crisis were driven by Dodd-Frank and in combination with Basel III, Basel IV. For the big banks, what matters, of course, is the combination of both the national regulations and the global regulations put in place after the crisis. And those were designed from the start, above all by Geithner, to allow maximum discretion to the regulators. And that was a political gamble. It was a gamble that the Democrats would remain, or people like them would remain in charge of the show. And as they lost political power, that opened the door to precisely what we're seeing now, this gradual erosion. And as you were saying early on, it's kind of a win-win situation from the point of view of kind of elite establishment Wall Street types who might very well have preferred Clinton as president, but now find that the profit making is a little bit easier.
Adam Tooze, the book is Crashed, How a Decade of Financial Crises Changed the World. We will put a link to it at majorityreportradio.com. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
And thank you for having me on.
All right, folks. Going to head to the fun half. I should tell you, this is a massive book. It's 500, almost 600 pages.
I'm going to take that.
What's that?
I'm going to take it.
You're going to take this?
I think so, yeah.
Convert the whole thing into audio?
Take screenshots of it with my iPhone.
And scan it, then put it into PDF form?
No, I'm probably going to get the audible of that one. I had The Deluge by him before, so I was excited.
Was it good?
We had him on. Yeah, very good. World War I era.
The next sound you'll hear is that book hitting the floor as I try and clear off my desk. In preparation for going into the fun half, ladies and gentlemen, just a reminder, this program exists because of its members. Its members make it possible for us to do a 40-minute conversation on a 500-page book. And that was, you know, from my perspective, having covered all of this stuff in real time to hear a cohesive notion of it, and to also see how the pathogen went around, and just the concept of the political implications of what happened on both right and left. It's fascinating. Not to, you know, toot the program's horn, but I mean, we are asking you to become a member and support it. Join themajorityreport.com. And when you do become a member, we give you extra content every single day, just about. I don't want to say anything, you know, but join themajorityreport.com. Also, going forward, one of the benefits you'll have as a member is that when you download the app, once it gets approved, as I mentioned, we had a little bit of problem with iTunes, but once it gets approved in the next day or two, members will be able to have exclusive ability to IM the show in the fun half. Members will have exclusive ability to search the entire archive. We're talking, what are we on show now? 2000? Have we hit 2000 yet?
This will be 1930.
Show 1930. And at one point, you know what we're going to do is put the deep archives up there. And then it's going to be, watch out. I mean, it's not going to be quite that dramatic, but. All right, so join themajorityreport.com. Also, make sure you check out the Michael Brooks Show. It happened on Tuesday. You can find it at iTunes or Stitcher or on the YouTube. Alona Minkowski was here. And check out Intifada at patreon.com/theintifada. And of course, Matt is the only person in the office besides Brendan, but the only person in the office who has his own podcast for the time being. God knows what Brendan's got planned. What's happening on Literary Hangover?
Well, we just did The Scarlet Letter, which many people are saying was the best episode that anyone's listened to of any podcast. And then
ever.
Yeah, and of better than Serial, even, people were saying.
Wow, that's, jeez, that's pretty good.
And as
are you consciously like now adopting like a Trumpian?
Yeah, exactly. That's okay. What I'm going for.
That's great.
That's how I can pitch things. I need,
you know,
to,
I gotta say, it's so smooth. Like I was like, wow, I gotta check that out.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
You start to understand the power of that.
There's exactly. And for members, I'm going to start reading audiobooks into the public domain, and once I get to 100 subscribers, and on Patreon, we hit 97 yesterday, so we're getting up there. Probably next week will be the start of my reading series, so check that out.
So now, what are you going to be doing? So these are public domain books.
Yep, this one came out.
That nobody makes an audible of, because why would you? You're not going to make any money off it.
Yep, and there's some, LibriVox is a volunteer organization where people read them for free, but there's certain books that I think are really good that people just haven't got to because they're not, you know, Dickens or the more famous ones. So I'm doing Catherine Maria Sedgwick's Hope Leslie, 1827, and nobody's done a reading of that. So I'm going to immortalize myself by squatting.
How many pages is it?
It's about 350. It's going to be about, I think, 14 hours.
Wow.
I'm told. Yeah. I know I need to get some, like, tea or something to keep my vocal cords.
You're not going to do it all in one shot.
No, it's going
to be episodic. I had to do FUBAR, and it was not easy.
Yeah. No, I've done it before. For before I found out about text-to-speech software, I used to try to do my readings in college just recording myself. And
then what, reread the book?
And then just listen to myself, listen to the chapters. And that's just too time-consuming. So,
man.
But yeah, anyway.
What an odd duck. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. I want to get in on that. I want to immortalize myself.
I know. I'm squatting these books. There's this one and The Quaker City by George Whitman.
It's not like someone's going to go like, you know, I didn't like Matt Leck's reading of The Quaker City. I'm going to take 14 hours and sit down and do it myself.
Exactly. I'll be the only show in town.
I got to pick out one that's really good. Maybe I'll do like the Constitution of the United States.
That's probably been done before.
That's probably been done before.
I think Glenn Beck did that on The Blaze.
All right. 646-257-3922. Quick break. Fun half. Bye. Oh. Folks, before we go, if you like the stories you hear on The Majority Report, check out the Sierra Club's new storytelling podcast, The Land I Trust. Season 2 of The Land I Trust brings you 14 storytellers from across the U.S. who share their experiences in harvesting, protecting, and living with the four natural elements, with tales of climate change, clean energy, and everything in between. Listen to The Land I Trust at beyondcoal.org/stories or on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook. Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.